Welcome to Seeds, a show where we talk with people who are living lives of purpose and doing amazing things that make a positive impact in our world. We take time to listen to them as they reflect on their life journeys and what has shaped them into who they are today and what motivates them to be involved in what they do. Well, kia ora, everyone. Welcome along to Seeds Podcast. This is Stephen Moe, and I'm glad you could join to listen to another episode where I got the chance to talk with Patricia Allen. Now, this was a really interesting conversation because she was born in 1938. So we find out all about the long life that she's lived and a number of different initiatives that she's been part of, including at the end, I asked her about the role of grandparents and grandchildren. So I know you're going to like this one. If you do, why not check out some of the other episodes in the back catalog? We're up to almost 400 life stories that we're cataloging here for Seeds Podcast. Now let's get straight into this conversation with Patricia. All right. So it's a pleasure to welcome Patricia Allen to the show. Thank you for joining me.
Well, thank you for asking me.
Oh, no problem. On this show, what we try to do is talk about people's lives
right. And
sort of find out what they're doing today, what's interested them in their lives. Mm-hmm. But before we ask questions like that, I like to go back in time and find out a bit about where the person's from.
Right.
So in your case, could you just describe a little bit about where you're from and what your childhood was like?
I'm the oldest child of three, and I was born in the Waikato, in Te Awamutu, and spent the first 10 years of my life up there.
Right.
My father actually worked at Tokunui Hospital as a psychiatric nurse, and my mother was also a nurse, so nursing, I guess, has been part of my DNA for quite a while.
Right.
And then we moved to Hokitika, where he was the head nurse at Seaview. So got involved there, and I started high school there, and then we moved over to Christchurch in my, third form.
Yep.
And so I did high school here and trained as a nurse at Christchurch Hospital.
Oh, interesting.
Then did midwifery training in Edinburgh, and on the way to Edinburgh worked in Israel, which was another part of my journey, important part.
Well, I think what I'll have to do is pause you because there's so many things you've already said.
Right.
I already have questions.
Okay.
So, for example, Israel. But going back right to the beginning, the first 10 years, that's you're old enough to remember.
Yes.
What was it like for those first 10 years? What was your childhood like? Did you enjoy the outdoors, or were you reading, or what was that like?
Yes. I think because I was born in 38, my earlier memories probably of the war.
Right.
And I was asked to speak recently at Rangiruru about those sort of memories of the war, and realised that was probably quite influential.
Yeah.
We lived on a little, what you'd call a 10-acre block now, I suppose, and a couple of cows and that sort of thing. So it was fairly rural and fairly... My parents weren't wealthy. It was a very basic but loving home.
Children these days probably have screens and, you know, computers
like
and things. But I'm just wondering, could you give us a picture of the early 1940s? Because the reality is most of the people listening will have no way of knowing what it was like. So as a child, like what sort of things, you know, it's kind of obvious to say this, but television is so dominant today.
That's
What were the things that you used to do as children?
I guess we just played with one another, really, and made up games. Had a little doll's pram, I remember, trundling along to the neighbour. It's really quite difficult. When I was quite young was when the polio epidemic was on, and so my mother was teaching us at home, and she found that very difficult. We read some that my father used to make up stories and tell us. And he used to read us Robinson Crusoe, and because he was a Robinson, we thought somehow Robinson Crusoe was related to us.
Right.
So I guess there's some sense of, you know, possible adventure and that kind of thing.
Yeah.
We used to go out to the hospital and learn how to dance and things with the psychiatric patients, which probably wouldn't happen now.
Right.
So things like that.
That's good.
So, I mean, I don't have any traumatic memories of childhood.
Yeah.
And We were happy and just... Yeah.
And when the war ended, like, this is wonderful to talk with you because not many people, you know, that I've spoken to would remember that. So you would have been, what, seven years old or six years old or something like
that? And I remember being at school when the bells rang and it was first victory, what do you call it? Victory in Germany.
Oh, okay.
But then I remember coming home and being all excited because everyone was excited and my mother saying, but the Japanese haven't, what's weird, I don't know.
Yeah, surrendered.
The Japanese hadn't surrendered because she was more worried about the Japanese, I think.
Right, because that was the Pacific, wasn't it?
And I remember her making up a food parcel to send to relatives in England and that sort of thing.
Oh, okay.
Stitching the calico around the tin or whatever it was.
Right.
Those sort of memories, I guess, lie deep within me.
No, it's great to talk about it because I think the reality is that for those of us who were born afterwards, you know, we didn't experience that or the trauma of a worldwide conflict that impacted everyone, including us here in New Zealand, didn't it? Yeah.
And my father had been at the First World War.
Okay.
So no doubt his... demeanor was affected by that.
Yeah.
And we learnt fairly recently that he was in the release of L'Equinoir, which was the end of the First World War.
Okay.
The New Zealand troops were responsible for freeing that part. And we went back there a couple of years ago and because they had the armistice celebrations there as well.
Mm-hmm.
Mm. Wow. So L'Equinoir... regards New Zealanders as being very special, I think.
Right, and he was there.
He was there, and that was a strange thing to go and realise that he'd been there.
Yeah, and reflecting back now, how do you think it had impacted him, the World War One experience?
He very seldom spoke about it, like many, many returned soldiers.
Yeah.
He used to make up stories, like he said, he'd been shot through the ear, which in fact he hadn't been attacked.
Right.
Yes, he was,
yeah.
He was a caring man.
Hmm. Yeah. Oh, that's good. Yeah. So you grew up in an environment where both of your parents are involved in nursing.
Yeah.
And then it sounds like you headed down that path as
well.
That's
right.
So was that what you just always assumed you would do, or why did you choose that?
Yes, I did for some time, and then I decided I wanted to be a teacher.
Okay.
And because my father used to play role plays with us, and he had me being a student nurse on the carpet because I'd given someone the wrong pills.
Uh-huh.
And I think, no, I don't want to do that. So right until the final year at high school, I was going to be a teacher.
Right.
But then went through this time of being very undecided and then decided on nursing. And by that time, I had felt a strong... what I would call a missionary call to Pakistan.
Oh, okay.
And so I really was weighing up what would be more useful, teaching or nursing.
Right.
So in the end, it was nursing.
Wow.
And making that decision was like many decisions in my life have been quite momentary almost. That's right, that's what I know, what I'm going to do.
Yeah, interesting.
Yeah.
Oh. And then you said that you ended up in Israel for a time.
Yes, that was only for 3 months. That was partly because there was a New Zealand doctor who was there and he was speaking at a conference I was at. And he said, any of you people going to England, stop off in Israel. So I had 3 months in Nazareth, which was just amazing.
Wow. And lovely. So what year would that have been?
62.
Okay.
It was Christmas of 61, I was in the beginning of 62.
Mm.
It's a long time ago.
It is, isn't it? What was the environment like at that time? Like, well, the nation state had been created, 14 years before or something like that? Was that?
And in Nazareth, it was largely an Arab town.
Uh-huh.
And I remember clearly taking prayers with the nurses through it with a translator and saying to them, did they pray for the government? And the translator turned to me and she said, you are right, sister, the Bible says we should pray for our enemies.
Hmm.
So I had no idea of the conflicts that were going on, really.
Right.
And the feelings amongst the Arabs.
Hmm.
But all around, even then, all around Nazareth, they were starting to build Jewish communities, so that would affect the vote and things.
Wow, interesting. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, it was certainly a time in it, you know, it was just beginning at that point, wasn't it?
Yeah, and I remember I went into Jordan as well, but also saw some of the camps, you know, out in the desert, and I thought, you know, bringing up children like that, what's going to happen? And,
Wow. Yeah, in terms of the mindset and the resentment that builds up from the way that people are treated. Interesting. And this is a complete aside, but I'm just curious, how did you used to travel from New Zealand back to Europe? Was it like a flight from here to Sydney and then Sydney to somewhere else? And
no, it was a flight from here to Sydney and then by boat.
Oh, boat.
I went on a Greek boat, the Patrice.
Okay.
And it stopped off in Greece, and then I flew into Israel. Ah. I had to have two passports because the boat had stopped and we'd gone into Egypt. Uh-huh. And to get into Israel, I had to have a separate... Anyway, there was quite a rigmarole around that.
Right.
And then I came out through what was then Jordan.
Okay.
Into Jerusalem. And that was one of the loneliest moments of my life because I was escorted by the hospital personnel to halfway into no man's land, and then I was met. They came from the other side.
Hmm.
So,
wow! So you remember that quite clearly.
Well, as we talk, yes.
Yeah. Interesting. Yeah. The reason I asked about the travel is that we take it for granted today that you can get on a plane and basically 24 hours you'll be in London.
Yes.
You know, it's amazing. But the reality, relatively short time ago, is that you went by boat or, you know, small planes.
Yeah, indeed.
Yeah. So what happened next? Were you in Europe for a while? Or
I did midwifery training in Edinburgh.
Okay.
It was a hospital... famous hospital there, the Simpson Memorial.
Mm-hmm.
And the woman, she just preceded us, wrote the standard textbook for midwifery, probably for the Western world.
Mm.
Maggie Miles, the name was. And so then I came back, and I had already been accepted as a missionary candidate. So I came back and went to the Bible Training Institute in Auckland in 63.
I see.
And did... a year there, but needed more nursing, so I did some work in Timaru Hospital in the theatres, and then on the West Coast, I've been back to Hokitika about three times.
Oh, okay.
And then went to Pakistan for 3 years.
Really? So that was the original place that you'd said you'd thought you'd go?
Yes.
In high school, I mean.
Oh, yeah, and that was very direct I was going with there.
Right, wow. Yeah. So what was it like at that time? What was Pakistan like?
It was fairly primitive, of course, but I went back with my family nearly 10 years later, and I don't think I would take my family there today.
Right.
I think things have got a lot more difficult.
Yeah, and you were working in midwifery as a nurse there?
Or? Yeah, as a nurse in a Christian hospital in a place called Sakura, which is on the Indus River.
Okay.
And at the time of the British Raj, they'd put a barrage across the river and were irrigating the south.
Right.
So, and the hospital had been established as a women's hospital, so it was largely midwifery kind of cases.
Right. Oh, and so... at that point, you kind of achieved your dream.
Calling,
calling. You were there in Pakistan.
Yes.
You said you were there for 3 years.
Yes, I had to come home quickly because I had a medical condition that they advised me, and that was, you know, quite suddenly the doctor said, I think you should go home.
Right.
And I think they thought it was cancer. Oh. So I had surgery and... was told the best cure was to have a child as quickly as possible.
Oh, okay.
And I didn't even have a boyfriend at that time. And anyway, it's another part of my life and my love stories.
Right.
So
what happened next?
When I was on the West Coast, just prior to going to Pakistan, I met a man at a one-day thing, and he told me that he was a forester, and I thought he meant a woodsman. So I sort of crossed him off any list of possibilities. And because I was invalid at home early, I was able to go before I had surgery to a conference, a missionary conference.
Okay.
And he was there again, so we re-met and just chatted and carried on. Anyway, I went into hospital and he sent me a get well card. Then he sent me a photograph of a group that he had taken at the conference, and then he sent me a Christmas card, and I thought, good grief, I haven't sent that fellow a Christmas card. So I sent him one. He worked in Wellington,
uh-huh.
but lived with his parents in Timaru. I said, oh, if you're passing through Christchurch and want a bed or a meal, you know, feel free, sort of thing.
Yeah.
And then in January I got a phone call from him. He wanted to come for tea on Saturday night.
Huh.
And I was so naive, but then I thought, well, this fella must be a bit interested if he's coming from Timaru.
Huh.
And he arrived and had tea, and we went out onto the patio, and he proposed marriage.
Really?
Yeah.
And wow.
He said...
I haven't heard that sort of a story before.
He said God had told him in that previous week he'd lost a lot of... And he was so sure. And I said to him, well, we used to talk about this in Pakistan. If someone came, it's God's will.
Yeah.
I said, in my view, there's only one way, and you know it's God's will. If someone loves you enough to ask you and you love them enough to say yes, I said, I don't love you. I don't really know you.
Yeah. Wow.
I met him the following week in Blenheim as he was on his way back to Wellington, and gave him the once over.
Uh-huh.
What do you think about this and this and this and this? And uh-huh. then I was... scheduled to start this work in Wellington, and by the time I arrived in Wellington, I decided yes, we'll get married.
Wow!
So we got married in the May holidays, I think, of the Diploma of Nursing course.
Wow! So pretty quick.
It was very quick.
Yeah. Well, I guess when you know, you know.
Well, as I say, it's been like that. It's like that for my second marriage too. It's
right.
another story similar. Oh. And a lot of my life, when I think back, has been like that, very instant, almost knowledge. And
right.
I might say it's the Spirit of God. I might say that it's just my intuitive nature. I don't know what
yeah,
it is. But,
yeah. But you make a decision and then
yeah,
you go with it.
And that's it. Yeah. And I've never regretted any of those decisions.
Yeah.
Mm.
Well, that's kind of reassuring for listeners as well, I'm sure. Because sometimes I think there are... paths in your life and you can choose this one or this one. And I've often felt and said to my wife, actually, she gets tired of me saying this, but it's the act of choosing which validates that
yes.
that path. And
I'm
sometimes
sure.
you need that I've got to make a choice, and you go for it, and that's the right one. Yeah,
that's right.
Oh, interesting.
Well, in a way, and I was thinking about, if you like, my religious life, and it was that kind of choice that I remember making, 2nd of August when I was 14, I think. And, you know, it was choosing which way you're going to live. The words of Jesus, you know, choose the narrow path that leads to life. And, so it's been like that ever since.
Yeah, interesting. Yeah, choose the path, huh? So just talk us through a little bit more then about what came next, because I know you had four children, is that right?
Yeah, we got married, and because I was 31, needed to start having family as quickly as possible. So my husband was transferred then to Hokitika as a forester. He was not a woodsman, he was a forester. So we went back to Hokitika, me it was a going back.
Yeah.
And we lived there, I think, for 21 years, might be even a bit longer. And so I had four children in 5 years. So
wow.
And then when the youngest was about four, I went back into nursing. I was teaching at the psychiatric hospital,
mm-hmm.
and then did some work, because the job was a part-time job. Did some work looking at social structures in Hokitika. I think I was probably interested in social relationships and things.
Mm-hmm.
And then one day I was sitting in church and the minister was talking about ordination, and I was cross with him. I said, no 18-year-old young men in the congregation of it. But it was, for me, it was then a call, and it came out of the church. I said to my husband, how would you like to be the husband of the next vicar of Hokitika?
Wow.
So then I went through the rigmarole of going into the selection process and training and whatnot.
Wow.
And so, yeah, I ended up as the vicar of Hokitika.
Did you really?
Yeah.
Wow. It feels like you know, you kind of see what the potential is, and then you work to get there. You know, I'm just thinking about Pakistan, for example, as a high school student, to say, well, I could be a teacher, I could do medicine, but I'm going to become a nurse so that I can go to Pakistan. And then you actually go to Pakistan.
Yeah.
And in this case as well.
Yeah, yeah, it's a bit like that.
Yeah.
And so, and then I was there, and then in 1994, I became what's called the Diocesan Mission Coordinator for Christchurch Diocese, was working in the bishop's office and seeing all the parishes and things.
Mm-hmm.
That job, which terminated for various reasons, and I had a year where I wasn't working, and well, I was doing some local work, but then in, I think it was 97, I became the minister at Durham Street Methodist Church. Mm-hmm. Still remained being an Anglican priest, but so I had 6 years there as an inner city ministry, which was really wonderful.
Mm.
And so, yeah, but I think another thing that sort of determined my path was in 89, there was an ordained women's conference, and there were 100 ordained women, and out of that conference came the first diocesan woman bishop, Penny Jemison, where she was selected, and also a whole issue of sexual harassment. And from that came what I call our own Harvey Weinstein case in Christ, in the church in Christchurch.
Right.
And I was quite heavily involved in that and could see that the church, like many institutions, was totally unprepared for dealing with this.
Mm.
And so I think it was in 92, the church sent me to the States to see what they were dealing with, sexual abuse cases and that kind of thing.
Hmm.
And so, and because of that, and, you know, I got interviewed and that kind of thing. Hmm. I then started hearing the cases and became involved in that. And because of that, that was partly why I lost my job, I think, as the Diocesan Mission Coordinator, because some of the fellows found it too difficult.
Right, getting too outspoken, maybe.
I think it's probably.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, anyway.
So you've had a variety of roles then over your life, haven't you?
Yeah.
Been involved in many different aspects of things.
Mm.
And I didn't introduce you with your proper title either, but it's actually Reverend Doctor, right?
Yeah.
So can you tell us a little bit about your doctorate research and what you were looking at? Because that would be of interest.
Or how it came about. Yes, yeah. So I retired from being minister at Durham Street in 2004, I think. And I was thinking about what am I going to do in retirement.
Mm.
And because my children were all having children, I was knee-deep in children and grandchildren. I'll write a book for grandparents and teaching people how grandparents have got a role in children's identity and belonging.
Right.
And I give myself 3 months off first. Mm-hmm. And in that 3 months, my husband was diagnosed with melanoma.
Oh.
And he died 15 months later.
Right.
So in 2005. And he, after he died, I was still thinking about this and thinking I need more knowledge about it. Mm. So I was listening to an interview, or I'd been thinking about it and thinking I'm really sorry I'd never been to university. It was the one regret of my life, really.
Right.
But I didn't have any plans to.
Yeah.
But I joined U3A, and I met an old fellow who said that he had just finished doing a honours at university.
Uh-huh.
And I thought, that's what I want to do.
Huh.
And then it was next morning on the radio, there was an old fellow of 80, I think, saying, if you're thinking of going to university, don't put let age put you off. It's got nothing to do with it. He was starting.
Wow.
So I cold called it. I got the university calendar, and I saw that anthropology is all about family and identity and all that stuff. So I cold called at the university.
Hmm.
and saw one of the lecturers, and she said, yeah, mature students do really well. They're not worried about their boyfriends or their hairdos. So I enrolled in anthropological topics.
Right.
Including death and dying, and my family said, for goodness sake. Anyway, I then graduated from that with a BA,
mm-hmm.
and to my astonishment, I'd won a scholarship for doing honours.
Hmm.
So I was all set to do honours in 2010.
Right.
And a man that I'd known 50 years before came back into my life.
Really?
Huh. Well,
how did that happen?
Do you want to know?
Yeah, I think so. It's interesting. Okay. How had you known him 50 years before?
He'd come to our Bible class when I was still at school.
Okay.
He was in working in the Air Force.
Mm-hmm.
So I sort of knew him then, and I'd seen him around. And then when I was in the Bible College in Auckland, he was a student. And one day he was doing cook's dishes, and I jokingly said to him, well, one day you'll make someone a wonderful husband, Peter. And he said, is that a proposal?
Yeah.
And he's already had a girlfriend whom he married. And we had a bit of connection over the years.
Mm.
We visited them in Australia, and they, I think, visited us on the coast.
Mm-hmm.
And then his wife died in 2002, I think.
Right.
And I knew, and he used to send out Christmas letters every year.
Okay.
From Australia. He was then in Australia.
I see. So you sort of knew he was out there. Yeah.
Well, I did, but I wasn't interested.
No, no.
But then, but I thought if I did remarry, it would probably be an old friend of some sort.
Mm.
Anyway, he sent a Christmas letter in 2009 and said he was coming to Christchurch because his son had just got a job here.
Oh, right.
So he turned up at church, or he rang me up, turned up at church,
huh.
And I said, oh, well, you know, I'd like to come for tea. Which he did.
Yeah.
And so then I think within a week we'd fallen in love and we were getting married. It was just...
Wow. You move very quickly, don't you?
I seem to.
Yeah.
I remember Hamish ringing me up and saying, Mum, a week ago this man rings and that won't leave his name because my daughter had taken the call.
Okay.
Next thing we know, you're going out for a meal with him.
Yeah.
And... and now you're telling us you're going to get married to him.
Right.
He said, we don't know him. I said, well, you've been in his home. And yeah, so we got married and, yeah, and that was in 2010.
Right.
And because of the, all the excitement of the getting married, I was one of the last ones married in the Christchurch Cathedral, actually. We either had to have a big wedding or a little wedding, so we had a big wedding.
Right.
And... So, yeah, we got married in June, and then I did half the honours
mm-hmm.
and did a thing on five-year-old birthday parties because I was really interested in how things are changing with, you know, with gift bags and all that stuff,
yeah.
Different games.
Yeah.
So then I signed up for the rest of that in 2011.
Okay.
And then... just before that, I went to, bought a new house up in Scarborough,
mm-hmm.
and we had a housewarming, and one of my daughters, who had three kids, gave me a card to go on the plane the next day with my sister to the Middle East.
Oh.
And so I said to my sister, I think she might be pregnant, because she wasn't drinking any wine last night.
Uh-huh.
And I got on the plane, and... opened the card, and she was announced that they were expecting twins.
Oh.
And it completely disrupted me. I thought, what am I doing this study for? I'm an old woman. My daughter's having twins. She's going to need more help.
Uh-huh.
Blah, blah, blah. And I was already committed to working on a chapel at the bottom of the cathedral tower.
Okay.
The powers that be had agreed to having a children's chapel there.
Okay.
That's what I'll give my energy to this coming year.
Mm-hmm.
And about 3 days before we were due to come back from the from Qatar, was the earthquake.
Mm-hmm.
And I was woken about 4 a.m. Didn't know for 24 hours whether the family was safe. And I saw the tower come down and I heard the mayor say, we will rebuild this stone by stone.
Yes.
And I thought, there's going to be so many arguments about that.
Yeah.
And it was, again, I was like, I'm saying this calling thing. Mm-hmm. That's what I want to do.
Wow.
I want to see what happens.
Yeah.
So
So what shape did that take then? What did you end up studying? Or what
well,
did you do
then
your research
I was also,
in?
I was all set to do the rest of honours that year.
Mm-hmm.
And so I started in March, or whenever you start.
Mm-hmm.
And the University of Oxford was offering specific places for Canterbury students. So I was one of 42, I think, who went to Oxford. And so I was able to finish the honours time in Oxford.
Mm-hmm.
And it was wonderful because it gave me the sense of where some of our history here had come from.
Yeah.
And
And at that time, I'm just curious, because you were born in 1938, you said, is that right? So at that time, because I find it quite liberating and it's wonderful that you were doing this intensive study at a time when most people would be, I don't know, doing other things.
Well,
because you were at that point, what, you were in your 70s or?
Yeah. Well, yeah. And so I had the time in Oxford, and because I was there, I was able to finish the honours, came back. Oh, no, before I came back was the June earthquake.
Right.
And my husband was due to join me in Oxford because I wanted to go to Germany to look at some of the reconstructions there of cathedrals and things.
Mm.
And he arrived a week after the earthquake, and his son rang him and said, you know, can't go back into the house, in this new house we'd got in Scarborough.
Oh.
So we came back as refugees, if you like.
Right.
And I was actually staying in my daughter's house when she had the twins. So anyway, so they had the rest of that year off, and then I went back to the university and said I wanted to do a doctorate in the cathedral. And my supervisor said, well, no, I need to do master's first. I said, why? He said, you need to learn to work on your own. I thought, if I'd never learnt to work on my own now, I never would. But anyway, to cut a long story short, I started with master's. I looked at all the stuff that was in the cathedral. There'd been good records kept, what had happened to it, all that.
Mm-hmm.
And after 18 months, I said to the other supervisor, is there a doctorate in this? He said, undoubtedly.
Right.
So that was then when I got into the doctoral.
Yeah. So what was your doctoral thesis title, or what was the topic?
Can't even remember.
well, it doesn't have to be specific.
The Once and Future Cathedral, I think.
Okay.
I think I called it.
Yeah.
But it was looking at what's called a social drama. There's a man called Victor Turner, who's an anthropologist, who worked with African tribes, and he gave a description of what can happen in a society, if you like, or a village or city, where there's a breach in normal accepted standards or rules or something, which provokes a crisis, and then there's a third stage where there's all sorts of efforts made to mend the breach.
Right.
And then the fourth stage is, if the breach is not mended, then there's a complete separation of the parties.
Hmm.
And in the village situation, the group would go off and start another village somewhere. And so I looked at what was happening in Christchurch like a drama, and identifying where the breach was, all the different crises that occurred, because and then everyone had an opinion. I don't think you were here at the time.
No, I wasn't.
You ask anyone, they'd tell you what they thought.
Yeah, yeah.
And
yeah, my parents were here, so we visited them a lot. So I saw a lot that was going on. But
And so finally, what happened was that the bishop decided she wouldn't make the decision; it would be up to the synod. And I was one that spoke at the synod, and I said, you know, 6 years ago I would have said, let's go for a new cathedral, but my research had shown that the feelings were so strong. And I said, if we vote for, no, we're not, we're going to have a new cathedral, that the Anglican Church will be out of the city, you know. Anyway, right. The rest is history.
So that became the thrust of the thesis was about that decision?
The thrust was really the social drama, looking at it as a social drama.
I see, yeah.
And interviewing people on what they thought and why they thought it. And
right. Interesting. So you would have spoken with Peter Beck?
He was one that I interviewed.
Yeah, he was on the podcast.
I've heard his podcast.
Have you? Yeah, it was a good... I really enjoyed talking with him about that time as well. You're right. It's a very unique situation for a city to go through a traumatic event that affects everybody in some way.
Well, I know I'd done some work on what's a city's icon, if you like, and it was the icon of the city. And I remember thinking, what would happen if the icon was destroyed? This is before it ever happened, and we found out, didn't we?
It's doubly unusual, isn't it, because of the name Christchurch, like itself, the cathedral did kind of represent something, didn't it? So when did you graduate, or when did you get your...
I think it was about 3 years ago.
Okay.
2 or 3 years ago, yeah.
Yeah.
And then I was in a dilemma as to whether I was going to put the thesis into a book, because there's some pressure to do that.
Right.
And I went, it must be a couple of years ago now, I went to a retreat...
Mm.
To sort of, if you like, ask God what I should do.
Mm-hmm.
But at the retreat, I was also thinking about, it was 30 years from we had this Harvey Weinstein situation.
Yeah.
I call it that. And I'm thinking that there should be or could be a look at what's happened in those 30 years.
Mm-hmm.
And the person that I had supervising me was very encouraging. He said, if not you, then who? You've got the research skills, the writing skills. So I talked with the Archbishop about it, because I didn't want to just sort of shoot off. And he said, very opportune, because, you know, the church and others are involved in the Royal Commission on Abuse.
Okay.
So I did most of the... he asked me to write a proposal, so I finished the first part of the proposal, which was looking at the kind of the history of each diocese. I don't know much about the Anglican Church, but there's Pākehā Diocese and Māori Diocese and Polynesian, but just the Pākehā Diocese, looking at their stuff. And I completed that around about Easter last year.
Okay.
And I was becoming very, sort of just before my birthday, I was thinking, I don't know, a bit despondent. And then I found a breast lump in Easter Monday, actually. So I said, I've got a new project. It's called Breast Cancer.
Oh, dear. Yeah.
So I've done that for this year. You know, do all this stuff. And now that I'm embarking on the second part of the research proposal, which is looking at the pastoral care that's given to complainants and their families, people complained against and their families, but particularly also institutions like parishes. So that's my story so far.
That's really good. But I love the way you say that. That's my story so far, because you're continuing, right? It's still being written.
Yeah.
And I think that's encouraging for me, you know, thinking about 40 years from now, what will I be doing? What will I be contributing to, hopefully?
Well, we don't know, do we?
No, we don't. I get the sense, and we spoke briefly before we started recording, but, you know, spirituality as a word or a concept, I'm just thinking, it sounds to like in your life you've felt that God has spoken to you, or there's been a calling. You know, you've used that kind of terminology. I'm just wondering how that has worked out, or how you've known or felt like this is what I should be doing. Has it been the same each time, or is it... Because it sounds like it happens very quickly for you.
It's an inner knowing, I think.
Right.
It's the only way I can describe it. It's not like hearing voices or seeing lights or anything. It's just, and it's a kind of, this is the path, walk in it. This is the way, walk in it kind of thing. It's very difficult to describe, but it's just a knowing.
Yeah.
And I know with in my first love affair, I can clearly remember walking across the road to my parents' home and thinking, you're going to marry this guy, you know.
Wow.
And the same second time round. Mm. In fact, we'd been out for dinner and my daughter rang me to say, how did you get on? I said, this man's going to ask me to marry him. Huh. And I don't know what I'm going to say. He was coming the next day.
Right.
And sure enough.
That's what happened. What did you say at that point? Did you say
yeah,
yes?
Yeah, I said, yeah. I said, wow. I'd sort of, the hormones or something had got going.
Yeah, wow.
Yeah.
That's amazing. Yeah. Yeah. I'd love to talk a little bit about something that you kind of hinted at before.
Right.
And it is that you said after you had first retired, so sort of 2005, you said you were looking into the role of grandparents and,
yes.
and grandchildren.
Mm-hmm.
And particularly given the context of your own life and your stage where you are,
right.
I would love to hear a bit of your wisdom on that topic, because I've often thought that grandparents and grandchildren, it's such a unique relationship,
yes.
and there's the potential there that maybe in Western culture we're not grasping in mm-hmm. terms of intergenerational knowledge and understanding
right.
that it's just sort of, well, the grandparents are over here and the grandkids are here. But, mm. you know, I have this wonderful example of my wife's uncle, and he took his grandson, age, I think, 10 or 11, and they went together to Europe.
Right.
And it's just such a wonderful testament to that relationship that they
yes.
would go off together for, like, I think it was 3 weeks
right.
traveling. And as the grandfather with the grandson, experiencing yeah. this together and mm. obviously telling stories and getting to know each other. Mm. I'm just really curious because you must have a number of grandchildren, right?
Well, yes, I've got 11.
11, right.
It's a bit hard to take them all to Europe.
Yeah,
I took
that's
my
true.
Oldest grandson, who was actually 25 the last couple of days,
mm-hmm.
And I took him to Australia.
Mm-hmm.
But it's a bit tricky with...
I agree. It's a lot of grandchildren. But the point isn't that you take them away. It's more the relationship and things.
Yeah.
Could you just comment on that?
I think I'm very fortunate because they all, the 11, live in Christchurch. So
right.
I see quite a lot. And and I like gatherings, you know, where we gather together. And I guess I find myself telling them a lot more stories about their parents
mm-hmm.
or the children and things that have happened, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
And he's just being an available person to them, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm finding now, as they're a bit older, several of them at high school, and even asking them each time, you know, what are you learning? And getting them to tell me about, so I'm learning from them what
yeah.
amazing things kids learn these days.
Yeah.
Yeah, so.
Oh, that's good.
But also I think the rituals are important, and that was what I was particularly going to write about.
Okay.
I don't mean necessarily religious rituals, but, you know, oh, when we go to Nanny's house, this is what we do.
Right.
These are the memories
of my grandmother or grandfather is that we always had peanut butter cookies and
yes.
we always watched this show or whatever it is,
yeah.
that type of thing.
Yeah. I mean, one of the rituals that's sort of stopped now, but I always had marshmallows. So when they got in their car to go home, they all had a marshmallow. Well, I mean, I suppose that's a ritual. But
that's pretty memorable, isn't it?
Well, I don't know.
As a kid. Yeah.
Yes.
And what would you say would be the advice or what would you like to tell your grandkids, your grandchildren, from your life? The reason I ask is that it's probably going to be applicable to all the listeners. So,
well, I was talking with one of my granddaughters stayed with me last night, and I was telling her that another lot of the grandchildren were upset about their brother going to Mount Cook because of the terrible things that could happen at Mount Cook. Anyway, I was saying to Isabella, a mantra of mine is worry about what is, not about what might be.
Mm.
And I said, have you heard that before? And so they've obviously caught that something that I believe.
Right.
That, you know, it's not much use worrying about what might happen tomorrow or the next day.
Yes.
It's what actually is now.
Right.
I would want them to have their own experience of God in whatever way that might be.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, three of the families all go to church. The other family, they have their kids in Christian school, so mm-hmm. they're getting some. But finding their own spiritual pathway, I guess, mm-hmm. I would want to encourage them in, mm-hmm. but not in a sort of overly religious way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, just recognizing that that's a part of human life.
Yes, and for me it's a really important part. And I know now with one of the things about cancer is they're saying the importance of contemplation and meditation.
Right.
And so I'm exploring more of that at the moment. Mm. Just being still and being quiet and
right.
and it's sort of deep knowing.
Sort of centering down the, and breathing.
Breathing and silence and those sort of things.
Yeah, there's a trendy word which is called mindfulness.
Yes, it's that kind of, which they're teaching kids now, of course.
Yeah, that's right, yeah. But the reality is if you look deeper beyond the label of mindfulness, there's actually a lot of tradition among many different religions, actually, including Christianity,
of course,
meditation and you know, being present.
And I think the importance of family, whānau, whakapapa, that I think is something that grandparents can share with their kids and tell them about. I had an 80th birthday, and my brother, who was 80 this year, he was dancing with one of the grandchildren. He lives in Geraldine, and I said to this grandchild a few days ago, I said, oh, I went to see your dancing partner, who was that? And she knew, you see, so they're kind of learning their connections with the cousins and all the rest of it, not in a I don't know, I think that's important.
Well, I think it's important that the children and the grandkids can look up and see your life and kind of hear about your life and see how you've clearly pushed at every stage, you know, that you would go back and study when in your 70s and get your doctorate when you're getting close to turning 80. You know, like that's quite a good example for the people coming up.
Thank you. Well, I think it's true that, and we have so many more opportunities now, of course, with the internet and
That's good. Yeah. Well, Patricia, thank you so much for coming in today. I've really enjoyed hearing about your life.
Thank you.
And I love the impulsiveness that you had demonstrated in many instances. Right. And I think sometimes we get caught up in, is this the right decision or not? But you know, in your case, you've made decisions and you haven't regretted them. And I think that's something that we can learn from. Sometimes we maybe think things through too much. And, you know, I'm just thinking the time when you made the decision to get married within a week, you know, like that's quite a big decision and it just happened.
And I think it is trusting that depth within ourselves, whatever that's called, spirit or soul or God or whatever you like. It's that... It's a trusting thing, I think.
Well, that's good. Well, thank you very much for coming on the show.
Thank you.
Well, I do hope you enjoyed that conversation. For me, there was lots of highlights, and I really appreciated that chance to reflect on her whole life and hear about so many different things that she's been involved in. If you enjoyed this, then why not check out some of the other episodes in the back catalog? And there's more information at theseeds.nz. Until next time, ka kite anō.